Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Figure It, a podcast where we look at the facts and statistics on Cyprus and figure out what it all means. My name is Fiona Mullen and I'm the Director of Sapienta Economics. This week I've brought Amanda Perry-Keseris, Professor of Law at Kent's Law School, onto the programme to talk about a workshop which she initiated with the Cyprus Peace and Dialogue Centre last November and in which I was also involved. In a nutshell, the workshop ran a small test on two concepts, citizens' assemblies and interspecies councils. We'll get to explaining what both of those are in a moment, but let me first say hello, Amanda, and welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Fiona. It's really lovely to have the chance to be here on Figure It.
So Amanda is no ordinary lawyer, and I would say no ordinary academic either. She's an elected fellow of the Design Research Society and of the Academy of Social Sciences. What I think makes her different is that she takes this cross-disciplinary approach to law, looking at the intersection of law with design and law with economic life. But you kind of have to see her in action to see what that means. What I really like about Amanda is her really fizzy mind when you're trying to tackle a tricky problem, including the Cyprus problem. So it's always a pleasure to work with you, Amanda.
Same.
So do you want to say a bit more about law and design before we get on to citizens' assemblies and interspecies councils?
Yeah, sure. So over the last 10 years or so, I suppose, I've been thinking about how lawyers, and by that I mean academics and practitioners, you know, lawyers as we normally think of them, how we can use methods from design to improve their legal work. And we often think about that work, we refer to it as legal design. And there's sort of four ways, designerly ways you can think of them, or designerly methods that I think are really especially useful for lawyers. And so the first one is a designerly mindset. So designers tend to think in a way that's sort of simultaneously practical, but also critical and also imaginative all at the same time. And I found that when lawyers adopt this mindset, they become much better at generating these more new and more useful ideas and really making them happen. And then the second way that designers behave, which is quite useful for lawyers, is that they make their ideas visible and tangible. So rather than just writing them down, as we lawyers are used to, so instead they might put an idea in an image or in a model. And I found that if you ask lawyers to do that, then they are able to allow their clients or their students, if we're talking about academics, to engage with their ideas more and maybe even to challenge them, which is always nice. We don't have the chance to challenge lawyers that often. And then the third part of design that's really useful is their emphasis on experimentation. So trying out lots of ideas and picking out whatever it is that works, quite free, but also systematic. And when lawyers embrace this kind of experimental attitude, they're a lot less worried about failure. They're a lot more likely to be innovative. And then the last thing is that designers are much better than lawyers at paying attention to the needs and wants of those that are going to use or be affected by the thing that they're designing. So kind of a user-centered approach. And when you encourage a lawyer or an academic to be more user-centric, then they become more interested in, or they become more confident about being interested in what the impact of their work is going to be and trying to make it more positive. So those are the kinds of insights that I was drawing on when I was collaborating with you and CPDC on this workshop. And I should note, before I forget, that workshop was funded by the Sociolegal Studies Association. So thank you to them.
So they found it useful. Can you give us a couple of examples? I know I have a little figurine of clay here on my desk as we're talking, and I know it can involve Lego and clay and things like that.
Yes, so clay for the economists. Yes, yeah. I've asked lawyers to explain the terms of a contract using Lego, and because the blocks are so simple and so familiar, you know, childish, of course, right? They're a really great way to let lawyers to start to communicate visually and simply, without being worried about whether the model that they make looks good, is it artistic or anything like that. And then I've also asked legal academics, like I asked you, to explain their theories by making clay models of them. So I remember a hilarious time with the University of Edinburgh Legal Theory Group, and they made a big old mess on this big mahogany table at their university. So that was great fun. But in each of these cases, the point is, the serious point is that the lawyers and the academics can end up explaining their ideas in a more accessible way, less technical way, and they always learn something new about their own ideas.
Yeah, it's interesting, this idea of creative play. So let's talk a bit about citizens' assemblies. As many of you know, this is my latest hobby horse, as I think it not only might help unlock ways of approaching the Cyprus problem, but also I think, as other people have noted, it should help mainstream political parties re-engage with citizens, which we know they're having a problem with all across the world. And it's ending up with, you know, oddballs, let's say, being voted into parliament or power and so on. But in short, a citizens' assembly is where a national government or local authority mandates an ordinary, randomly selected cross-section of citizens to deliberate on a difficult policy question or questions. And they get together quite often for weeks or months, a bit like a sort of extended jury service, and they come up with proposals. So the first part of our workshop with Amanda was giving a group of about 20 of us a kind of crash course on the main principles for making sure the citizens' assembly is run properly. And I want to say that we made a deliberate choice here at this stage, because this is an iterative process, and we deliberately chose what we call Cyprob veterans, you know, people who know about the Cyprus problem, have a lot of Turkish Cypriot, Greek Cypriot friends. So they were kind of comfortable in a multi-communal environment, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. And we had a great group of people as well. Yeah. And very carefully selected. Correct. Yeah. So when we started out, we wanted to begin, I suppose, by introducing everybody to the basics. So, of course, some people would know about deliberative democracy already, but we wanted to have a baseline knowledge so that we'd all be in a good position to think about whether it might be possible, whether it might be useful to ask a citizens' assembly to get involved in redesigning the peace process for the future. And actually, it's important here to note that when we were introducing citizens' assemblies, we relied totally on the resources from Democracy Next, because it's such a highly regarded leader in the field of open democracy. And it produces lots of freely available and really accessible materials. And it's also a transnational focus. So we thought that was a really good baseline position to start from.
Yeah, it's really great. It's kind of spoon feeding everything that you do before, during and after an assembly. It's really great.
Yeah. Really nicely designed materials, yeah. Yeah, so we used their materials to give some examples of where and for what purposes assemblies have been used in different places around the world. And like, just to give you maybe an example, like we pointed to the recent assembly in France on end-of-life care. So that was 184 randomly selected citizens. And they fed into the policy. They were invited to do so by President Macron. And they deliberated for 27 days across 4 months. So it was really an extensive process. And they managed to get 92% consensus.
Wow.
Around 67 recommendations, which is quite impressive. And those fed into the policy process. So, yeah. And then, so having sort of given a sense that deliberative democracy is used in various places around the world, we then really honed in on what might make them useful. As compared to other kinds of methods that you might use to get input from the public. And here we were interested in the fact that because they're conducted under a political mandate, so there has to be some kind of approval, involvement from those who have political power, and because they emphasize evidence-based deliberation, so it's not just, oh, my opinion, you know, out of thin air, then it allows citizens to make a contribution to the policy process that's much more likely to be meaningful for the policymaker and for the citizen themselves.
Yeah, I think that's one thing. You know, whenever I talk about citizens' assemblies, people say, oh, but the politicians will never accept it. But the whole point is that it has a political mandate. So the idea is not that we start a citizens' assembly without getting the buy-in of all the political parties across the two communities. We have to get that buy-in. I know it's a huge, huge ask, but you have to start somewhere. But I also think this, yeah, it's more than just a focus group because of the way in which it's conducted, you know, so it's more structured. You don't just sit people down and say, what's your opinion on X?
Yeah.
Because you need a decision, so you need a whole bunch of elements to make sure it's going to be successful, right?
And I mean, this was really important because, you know, bringing this sort of designerly mindset in, we were thinking we don't want to just be critical of what there is. We don't want to be imaginative about what there could be. We also want to be practical. How can we make this happen? If people want it, of course. So that's why we invited the participants to complete these two briefs, we would call them, or activities that were designed to highlight these two conditions of success. That's the terminology of Democracy Next. For any citizens' assembly, so to say, what would it take practically, and then to support them also to then begin to consider how you might secure those conditions of success in Cyprus, how the participants, you know, could think it through. So the first condition of success that we focused on, that was identified by Democracy Next, is that a citizens' assembly needs to be directed towards what they call a clear task. It needs to be linked to a defined public problem. And how to choose that defined public problem. So we invited our participants to work in small groups and to kind of assess which of a range of questions might be suitable for consideration by a possible citizens' assembly. And we used criteria that were in, you know, listed by Democracy Next, you know, suggestions about what kind of things make a good question and whatnot. So we got them really talking about it in the detail of the question here. Yeah.
So just to clarify for listeners, the first question tackled wasn't how do you solve the Cyprus problem or even how to solve the Cyprus problem using a citizens' assembly. But roughly speaking, if you were to have a citizens' assembly in which we were trying to redesign the process, what would be the questions that the citizens' assembly should tackle? So, you know, what answers are we looking for?
Yeah, exactly that.
So to sort of roughly summarise, there were five different questions, all kind of different levels, if you like, of citizens' engagement. So the first one was how, if at all, should citizens be involved in negotiating possible outcomes of a peace process? So that would be citizens involved in negotiations. The next one would be how should they be involved in choosing the outcome of the negotiations? The third one was essentially about how they get informed and what aspects they should be informed about and updated about along the way. The fourth was how they should be informed along the way. And the fifth one was sort of completely different in a sense that it was what questions should the negotiators tackle? You know, should it be Guterres framework or something completely different?
Yeah, so we moved on from after we asked them to consider all of these different possible questions that could be put to a citizens' assembly and which one might be realistic or which one's just crazy because there's no way they could even begin to deal with it or it's not useful or whatever. The second thing we said was, now that you've selected a question that you think is reasonable to put to a citizens' assembly, how are you going to make sure that they have the information that they need in order to address it? So because a second condition of the success that's of a citizens' assembly that's identified by Democracy Next is that citizens need to have access to a wide range of information that is accurate, that's relevant, that's accessible, and the opportunity to hear from and to question experts. So again, you know, it's really important that people trust the information that they've got and that they can really engage with the experts who are giving them that information, especially in a time of disinformation. No? So we asked participants to say, now that you've chosen your question, what kind of information would the Citizens' Assembly need in order to answer it? And then where could they get it from? From what kind of sources is that information available in Cyprus today or elsewhere? And these activities, they really, they generated like so much discussion amongst the participants. I don't know what you thought. I was really excited by the way that they could engage with the realities. And they were seeing information that they already had in a different light and seeing how they could repurpose it or how,
Yeah, and also aware, I think, of the fact that people might not necessarily believe someone who's known to be a peacenik, let's say.
Correct.
There was an acknowledgement that you need people that everyone's going to trust. But I think what's really clear, and everybody acknowledged, there was certainly outside, let's say, pro-peace circles, there's not much knowledge about what goes on in the negotiations. I mean, a lot gets leaked, but unless you're a total geek like me, you don't pay attention.
Yeah.
But even so, even within peace circles, I mean, sometimes I'm telling people in pro-solution circles what went on in negotiations that they didn't know about either. So, yeah, how do you do that? How do you do it in a way that people can trust is obviously critical.
Yeah.
So that was citizens' assemblies. Then one thing that Democracy Next encourages in its very useful set of guidelines is the use of innovative practices. So this is where you are in your element, Amanda. We try to find ways of loosening people up, so to speak, different approaches to things, opening up their imaginations and so on. And obviously, as we said before, this can take on many forms, but the one that you picked on for the workshop in November was the notion of an interspecies council. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, this was the point. This is in the afternoon, where we pushed ourselves a bit out of our comfort zone, right? So the term interspecies council was developed quite recently by this independent research and practice centre in the UK. It's called Moral Imaginations. But as they acknowledge, it builds on a long, long history, which traces back not only to some academics before, but also way back before that to various indigenous communities around the world. So it's not a private resource here. It's a shared resource. And the basic idea of an interspecies council is that you get human participants to gather together and to represent the interests of an animal or a plant in a deliberation about the future, usually in relation to a very specific location. So it's about species and places. Mm-hmm. And usually the aim is to make sure that the voice of nature, of non-human beings, is taken into account by humans. Because, of course, we tend to be very much concerned with our own perspectives and we don't really have a way of accessing what animals and nature think. So it's a very deliberate effort to try and bring the non-human into the human decision making. And so, I mean, even, for example, the UK government recently experimented with using an interspecies council to start a conversation between civil servants and also activists and local community members about the future of a particular river in Essex, this River Roding. So quite unusual, experimental. So normally it's about bringing nature into the conversation, but I was thinking maybe we can use this kind of device where you unsettle people and get them to think from a different perspective to generally open people up, open up their imagination. And that might be really quite useful in preparation for a citizens' assembly. I was thinking in Cyprus, for example, you maybe need two kinds of imagination. So maybe one kind of imagination that's hard is thinking about things from the perspective of the other, of the person or from another part of the island or from a different perspective that you don't really get. So that's a useful kind of imagination. And then also just the possibility of thinking that the world could be different, you know, the island could look different. So opening up one's imagination to the possibility of a completely different future. So that's the two. We were wondering whether an interspecies council could kind of get people in the zone, in the imaginative zone, before they went into a citizens' assembly to be able to make the most of it.
Yeah. So we briefed everyone on citizens' assemblies and then briefed them on the concept of interspecies councils. And then it was time to get to work. You made some lovely cards for us with pictures of all kinds of creatures and plants and so on with images and information.
Yeah, I had such a great time. I mean, normally as an academic, I don't get to do this kind of thing, but I had such a hoot in the months leading up to this workshop, exploring all the flora and fauna of Cyprus and trying to create the ideal selection, you know, a nice diverse range. So I designed this set of cards, one for each species, and each of the participants was going to put it around their neck like a label, right? So they could represent their species. And I tried to include a really diverse range of species, including plants and animals and insects, ones from the land, one from the sea, ones that are indigenous to Cyprus, endemic to Cyprus, ones that have been introduced to Cyprus intentionally, ones that have come in by themselves, they're referred to as invasive. Ones that are here now, ones that are extinct, wild, domesticated, feral, as many as possible to try and give people provocations to think about things that I wouldn't think of myself. Yeah, so each of the cards had like a picture on the front and some basic information on the back about like the lifespan of the species and its size, where it lives, what kind of behaviors it has and so on. And then we asked people to use those cards to learn about their species and then very quickly, actually, to turn around and represent the species in a group discussion and to try and present their perspective.
Yeah, that was really interesting. So I remember we had colourful parrotfishes, we had a Cypriot cow, we had corals, mushrooms, etc., mouflon. Mm. So as you said, both species that are native to Cyprus and ones that arrive later. And then we were all given specific questions to answer about these species, right?
We asked them to share three insights with the group, with the rest of the council, with the other species, we should say. And those insights should come from the perspective of the species that they were representing. Mm-hmm. So we asked them, first of all, to talk about their hopes and fears about the future And then what do they miss or not miss about the past? Like, what do they, they're thankful mm-hmm. that they moved on from, and what do they wish they could still have? And then the third one was about whether they had any distinctive knowledge about the past, about the present, about the future, whatever, that they could give, share to the other species that might be useful to other species to know, something that's distinctive from their perspective that they can see because mm-hmm. of who they are and where, how they live. Yeah. And I mean, their answers were fascinating, actually. People mm-hmm. really got into this, I must say. I mean, do you remember we had the parrotfish, which told us that we're all capable of radical change. And they know this because most of the, I had no idea about this, but most parrotfish transition from female to male during their lifetime. So they know all about being able to change, right? Radical change. And I loved the pygmy hippopotamus, which was a sad one, actually, not uplifting, because the pygmy hippopotamus was made extinct probably by humans about 14,000 years ago. And naturally, they tell us that nobody is sacred. You know, any of us can be made extinct. The lionfish, which told us that, you know, we think about the lionfish as an invader, and the lionfish said on its own behalf, but maybe I'm coming in peace and I actually have some skills. I'm very adaptable. That's how I get to move around the world in this way. And maybe you can learn from me. Mm-hmm. We had the Cyprus cat, a very interesting common sight. mm-hmm. Who knew? I mean, I didn't know there's an actual species of Cyprus cat, but anyway. And they were really interesting as well, saying, you know, it's so nice to be able to move around the buffer zone with freedom. You know, I don't have to worry about anything. Nobody stops me. But actually, when I do that, it also brings me into contact with others that are free moving and so on. And that can be a bit unnerving. So that was a nice insight. And then there's the pillow coral, which is very sweet, which grows and grows and eventually adheres to its neighbors. And it told us that when we grow as individuals, we make our communities more stable and strong. So we had a really wide range of insights there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So in terms of your main takeouts from this, what do you think were our main lessons from the workshop?
Yeah, I think I took two things from this, and one doesn't like to generalize or take too much of a leap from what one found, you know, but I definitely think it's really reasonable to expect that there will be general support, at least amongst civil society actors, for exploring the possibility of citizens' assemblies. We definitely didn't get the sense that this was a crazy idea at all. There was a lot of positive talk about it being a possibility, yeah.
Yeah, so I found, I'll be doing a podcast on this with Miltem in the coming weeks, but we did another exercise in December and people really felt kind of grateful that they'd been asked their opinions about things. It wasn't an interspecies council, it was something else, but I think it's more than reasonable, pretty strong expectation that you would get support for citizens' assemblies.
Great, yeah. So my academic caged response, yeah, mm-hmm. we can update that, yeah. And I guess actually the other thing is, so that's like the general principle that citizens' assemblies seem to be something that is really, you know, it's worth pursuing, definitely. And also that then if you do have a citizens' assembly, it really should focus on making sure that it's designed to support the imaginative capacities of the members, not only their practical and their critical capacities, but also their imaginative capacities, because it's just going to be really important for allowing people to engage with each other. And something that came out of the workshop in particular is that it should make space for emotion, for the fact that people have strong feelings. There's no point in ignoring it. And in fact, you can use it to bring people together because people feel strongly about something. But it's really a delicate process. And any of these, you know, creative practices like interspecies councils can help. But definitely, like citizens' assemblies, these creative practices, they really need to be carefully planned, inclusively, and in a very context-specific way. So it needs to be a Cypriot affair, all right? It needs to be something that is made for Cyprus.
Yeah, which is why it was so nice that you did you spent all this time looking up in the big heavy book all the flora and fauna of Cyprus. I think one thing I learned from it, more practical lesson in running assemblies, that people really got attached, didn't they, to their identities. That was kind of interesting. But also, I think we asked some three questions. They might not have got so much into the third part, which is where I think they had to tell us what knowledge about the past, present and future they could share with other species. So for our next iteration, when we did this thing with UNDP, which, as I said, we'll be talking about later, we gave more time for deliberation, because that was something that we learned from this, was that the more time to deliberate, the better. But obviously we had quite a long day anyway, because we were trying to do two things with your workshop.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, deliberation per se in a citizens' assembly per se, it takes a lot longer than people would think. And mm-hmm. then especially when you get into this kind of creative business of an interspecies council and you're asking people to extend themselves and to get into something, and then they do, and then they go off track. So you have to be really on it, you know.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, these participants, they really latched onto their species. They got super invested in them. They were like basically substituting their own species mm-hmm. identity for their own. And we didn't anticipate that at all. Maybe my cards were too good. What can I say? You know? But here it was really interesting that one participant said that if we do this again, this kind of activity, you should ask people to swap species multiple mm-hmm. times during the council, because then they can let go a bit, you know, and that would really be the point of the exercise. I thought that was a great mm-hmm. insight, and really just a reminder. It's especially important to me, you know, coming from the UK into Cyprus. Obviously, I have a long connection with Cyprus, but I'm very aware that I don't live there, you know. So it's really just constantly lovely to see how much expertise, experience, creativity is there in Cyprus. You know, Cyprus doesn't need help, right? There's plenty of people in Cyprus who have this like oven ready, you know, approach, knowledge, expertise is really ready to be applied to whatever good ideas are available.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it looks like we're heading in the opposite direction of everything basically decided by the bigger powers.
Don't be despairing.
You know, a friend of mine said that I treat the Cyprus problem like a 12-sided Rubik cube. I keep trying to say, oh, just one more twist and we'll do it, you know.
I can't even do a normal Rubik's Cube. Please don't make it that big.
So I think we've reached the end of our time, but thank you very much, Amanda.
Yeah, thanks so much. I had a really great time. Thanks for the collaboration. Yeah.
So Figure It is brought to you by Island Talks. It's the only trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. If you want to pay for the overheads, they don't go to me. They go to things like website subscriptions, etc. Go to islandtalks.fm. That's islandtalks.fm. That's it from me. Thank you. Goodbye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.